The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
Don't have time to keep up with the news? Try the CBS News Radio app on your iOS or Android device. You'll get the latest news as soon as you start it up.
CBS News Special Report.
It's that easy. You can also listen to great programming like Face the Nation, Weekend Roundup, or the CBS Evening News with Jeff Glor.
We're going to begin with our interview with the president late this afternoon.
You can even download them straight to your phone and listen later. It's all on the CBS News Radio app for iOS or Android. Download it today. This is the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
New wildfire concerns in California amid storms.
I'm worried about it hampering the search. I'm worried about it creating risk to the searchers.
Plus, the president's controversial defense of U.S. ally Saudi Arabia.
We're not going to give up hundreds of billions of dollars in orders.
And now, from the Capital One Bank Studios in the CBS News Washington Bureau, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Let's start this Thanksgiving weekend out in California, where there's mudslide and flooding concerns where wildfires have been raging as the search for hundreds of missing people continues.
Federal search and rescue team member Brian Ferreira says the pressure is on.
I'm worried about it hampering the search. I'm worried about it creating risk to the searchers.
Butte Sheriff Corey Honey says the threat of mudslides would stress an already fragile community.
It is the potential of having dealing with one disaster and having, you know, something else pile on top of us.
In nearby Chico, officials are warning evacuees in this tent city to move to shelters because the parking lot where they are is in a flood zone. But with tens of thousands of evacuees, the question is, where should they go?
Are you prepared to handle the amount of people without homes?
Yes.
Kevin Hannes with FEMA says it's unclear if trailers will be brought in to handle the displaced. He says many people are in hotels or have found new places to rent, adding that the FEMA Assistance Center has been busy processing about 1,500 people a day.
This is not a normal disaster where we've lost a residential area. We've lost the residential and the essential elements of safety and security inside the town of Paradise specifically.
Officials expect people to be in those shelters through the Christmas holiday. Meg Oliver, CBS News, Paradise, California.
First turkey and Duncan Hines cake mix, then ground beef. Now add romaine lettuce to the list of foods causing concerns this Thanksgiving.
The CDC here in Atlanta is warning you not to eat romaine lettuce because it may be contaminated with E. coli.
So this is the whole romaine, hearts of romaine. Salads with romaine lettuce in it, anything with romaine, we're asking them to throw out.
The CDC's Tom Skinner says if you don't know if it's romaine or not, don't eat it. 32 cases have been confirmed in 11 states. More than a dozen people have ended up in the hospital. Safeguards were put into place last spring after another outbreak of romaine lettuce contaminated with E. coli. Sabrina Cupid for CBS News Atlanta.
President Trump is defending U.S. ally Saudi Arabia while vacationing at Mar-a-Lago in Florida, taking to Twitter to credit the country with low gas prices. It follows his support for Saudi Arabia in remarks Tuesday, despite its rulers being accused of orchestrating the murder of writer Jamal Khashoggi. More from correspondent Weijia Jiang.
It's a very complex situation. It's a shame, but it is what it is.
That's how President Trump described the killing of Washington Post contributor Jamal Khashoggi just moments before taking off to spend Thanksgiving at his Florida resort.
$3 billion. $533 million.
The president said he will not scrap an arms deal with the Saudis or punish its crown prince, Mohammed bin Salman. U.S. officials tell CBS News the CIA concluded bin Salman ordered the murder, but Mr. Trump suggested they were not certain.
The CIA has looked at it. They've studied it a lot. They have nothing definitive.
Earlier, President Trump said in a statement, it could very well be that the Crown Prince had knowledge of this tragic event. Maybe he did, and maybe he didn't, adding, in any case, our relationship is with the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia. Khashoggi entered the Saudi consulate in Istanbul on October 2nd and was never seen again. The Saudis have since admitted he was killed while inside. Despite the kingdom's role in the murder, the president defended his decision to maintain strong economic ties to Saudi Arabia.
Because it's America first for me. It's all about America first. We're not going to give up hundreds of billions of dollars in orders and let Russia, China, and everybody else have them.
It's a mean, nasty world out there.
Secretary of State Mike Pompeo echoed the message.
By the way, this is a long, historic commitment and one that is absolutely vital. to America's national security.
Congressional criticism of the administration has been swift. Republican Rand Paul said the president's statement was Saudi Arabia first, not America first. And Democrat Mark Warner said it was a retreat from American leadership on issues like human rights. Still, President Trump said he'd be open to meeting with the Crown Prince when he attends a global summit later this month. Weijia Jiang, CBS News, West Palm Beach, Florida.
Ivanka Trump is under scrutiny for her use of private email.
Ivanka Trump used a personal email account to send hundreds of emails about government business last year. A spokesperson for her ethics counsel said in a statement, while transitioning into government, Ms. Trump sometimes used her private account, almost always for logistics and scheduling concerning her family. Austin Evers is the executive director of the liberal watchdog group that exposed the email use.
She claims she didn't know the rules, and I'm not sure there's anyone in the country, let alone the Trump family, who can claim they don't know the rules on government email.
President Trump frequently criticized Hillary Clinton's use of a private email server when she served as Secretary of State.
This is the biggest political scandal since Watergate.
Some of Mrs. Clinton's emails were later deemed classified. We don't know if the same is true for any of Ivanka Trump's emails. White House lawyers relied on Ivanka Trump's personal attorney to review her private emails and forward work-related emails to them.
Thank you all very much.
Democrats may want to dig a little deeper. They take over the House of Representatives in January and could launch an investigation. Mo Lalenghi, CBS News, The White House.
A judge has temporarily blocked action by the president to prevent migrants from seeking asylum without going to an official border crossing. It comes as the Trump administration says it's taking new measures to prevent that caravan of migrants now in Mexico from entering the U.S. Here's White House correspondent Stephen Portnoy.
CBS News confirms a White House memo gives troops on the border the authority to use lethal force if necessary to protect border agents from violent migrants. Military Times, which first reported the existence of the order, says it also authorizes the troops to conduct crowd control, temporary detentions, and searches. But those are all law enforcement functions, raising questions about whether soldiers are being ordered to cross a legal line set by the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878.
More from correspondent Ileana Diaz.
Angry protesters scuffled with police at a shelter where Central American migrants are staying in Mexico. Tensions have been building in Tijuana as nearly 3,000 people from a caravan poured into the city. Demonstrators carried banners reading, "No to the invasion," and "Mexico first." This protester fears because of the migrants, President Trump will close the borders, making it hard for Mexicans who have to cross daily for work. Tijuana's northbound border was in fact temporarily closed to cars and pedestrians Monday morning as the Department of Homeland Security fortified the border. President Trump tweeted a picture of a new fence on the beach and said, "No climbers anymore." The Department of Homeland Security believes most people in the caravan will not qualify for asylum based on new policies by the Trump administration that preclude victims of domestic abuse and gang violence from qualifying. Ileana Diaz, CBS News, Los Angeles.
Coming up, another deadly attack in Afghanistan. That's next on the Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
More deadly violence in Afghanistan. More than 40 people have been killed in another suicide bombing in Kabul and more than 80 wounded. CBS News correspondent Cammie McCormick is at the Pentagon with more.
This latest attack was on a wedding hall in the Afghan capital where top clerics were meeting. It's one of the deadliest attacks in Afghanistan this year, but it comes amidst an upsurge in violence across the country. In his latest report, the Pentagon's inspector general said the U.S. and Afghan governments have made little clear progress recently against the Taliban, even though military leaders and Trump administration officials insist the strategy is working.
45 years ago, the U.S. was on the brink of nuclear war, only the second time the country has been at DEFCON 3. That's the highest state of readiness for armed forces. As Soviet involvement in the Yom Kippur War was escalating in the Middle East, the decision to go to DEFCON 3 was made without President Nixon. Retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland is a CBS News military consultant. Jeff, first remind us what DEFCON 3 means.
What DEFCON 3 means is all U.S. military forces are put on the highest level of alert. All nuclear weapons are manned, and in preparation for the possibility of war breaking out at any possible moment.
So why was this decision made then by the National Security Council without President Nixon?
Well, what happened was, of course, this was during the period of the so-called Saturday Night Massacre. And then the following week, there was a great uproar across the United States, Nixon being very concerned, as was Henry Kissinger, his national security advisor, that the Soviets, in the middle of this international crisis, would take advantage of Nixon's domestic weakness. So in any event, that particular evening, the Russians had threatened to send Soviet airborne forces to Egypt, reinforce the Egyptian army, which was surrounded in many places by the advancing Israelis. The decision was made to put U.S. forces on the evening of the 24th to DEFCON 3, a couple days after the Saturday Night Massacre, because of this potential Soviet threat. But as you said, President Nixon was not available. He was in the family room, and periodically throughout that meeting, and I interviewed several of the characters who were there that night, Kissinger would go upstairs and come back and say to the group, the president says this is what we should do.
Can you remind us a little bit about the complexities of the Saturday Night Massacre, what happened, and its impact?
Well, of course, this all began with the Watergate break-in in June of 1972, but as has this crisis unfolded, later in the summer, of course, Archibald Cox had been appointed as a special prosecutor by the then Attorney General Elliot Richardson in May of 73. Cox had requested that the White House release the tapes of recordings in the White House Oval Office between President Nixon and others, and he had gone to the Court of Appeals to appeal the fact that the White House resisted this move. The Court of Appeals had ruled on the 12th of October that the president had to turn these over by the 19th of October. 19th of October, President Nixon would speak to the nation saying that he was going to release Archibald Cox, particularly because of this concern about the international situation. And Cox was fired on the 20th, setting off this crisis at home. That, of course, was a Saturday night. On Monday morning, massive amounts of telegrams, phone calls all across the nation as the nation faced a constitutional crisis.
All right, so it seems like a bad time to declare an international crisis when you have one going on at home. Looking back on that, how necessary was going to DEFCON 3 and then sending that message to the Soviets?
It seems to be that Nixon may have overreacted. Some actually have argued that he tried to use this particular effort to distract the American public from the situation with Watergate.
Jeff, Richard Nixon was not available to the NSC making this decision, but then on the Russian side, their leadership was absent as well.
That's right, Steve. Many people actually believe on the U.S. side that I have interviewed who were there at the time that the president may well have been intoxicated on that Saturday night, totally beset by his domestic challenges. But in Moscow, then leader of the Soviet Union, Leonid Brezhnev, apparently was having his own personal difficulties. He was so stressed out by this particular crisis. Sadat in Egypt, a client, was calling him repeatedly for more and more Soviet aid against the Israelis. He had retreated to his Dacha. And it was now believed, based on what's been released from Russian archives, Brezhnev was abusing sleeping pills combined with alcohol.
Let's talk about how this is relevant 45 years later.
There seems to be the distinct possibility that President Trump might consider firing Mueller, the special investigator for the ongoing Russian scandal. And in fact, that could set off the same sort of constitutional crisis because, in effect, the president can't fire him. He has to be fired by the attorney general. And, of course, the president had just fired Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, and placed someone in the position that many people feel is a greater supporter of President Trump, and they therefore may do that. So the same sort of constitutional crisis might be set off.
CBS News military consultant, retired Army Colonel Jeff McCausland, on his research on the Saturday Night Massacre, DEFCON 3, and its relevance to today. Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks, Steve.
The value of the British pound has plunged amid questions about the future of Prime Minister Theresa May following the rocky debut of her plan to leave the European Union.
Prime Minister Theresa May warned that a change in leadership wouldn't make Britain's divorce from the EU, known as Brexit, any easier.
What it will do is bring in a degree of uncertainty. That's uncertainty for people and their jobs. I'm clear people voted for us to leave. We will leave, and we'll leave on the 29th of March, 2019.
The defiant Prime Minister appears to have survived a week where support for both her proposed deal and her ability to see it through were questioned. The drama began during a tense five-hour meeting of the cabinet where ministers reluctantly agreed to sign off on the draft, which critics say keeps the UK financially bound to the EU. But the following day, several ministers quit May's government, including Dominic Raab, her chief Brexit negotiator. While her defiant stance has calmed many, others within her party are calling on May to resign.
And there are more hurdles ahead. The deal needs to be signed off by British Parliament before a final draft can be approved by the European Parliament and the 27 member states. The true fallout of an exodus like this is unknown, but it's fair to say such uncertainty is likely to impact financial markets around the world, including the U.S. Jonathan Vigliotti, CBS News, London.
Back home, Chicago is spending this Thanksgiving remembering the victims of a gunman's rampage at a hospital.
Chicago police now identify the gunman in Monday's hospital shooting as 32-year-old Juan Lopez. Witnesses say he argued outside Mercy Hospital with his ex-fiancée, Dr. Tamara O'Neill, before he killed her. Lopez then ran inside the hospital where police say he killed a resident pharmacist, Dana Less, and Officer Samuel Jimenez during a shootout.
They did with what the heroic officers always do. They ran towards that gunfire.
Jimenez was a father of three. An ambulance carried his body in a procession through the streets of Chicago.
This tears at the soul of our city.
Staff at the hospital recently went through active shooter training. Some workers risk their lives to help patients.
I couldn't leave them because they were, you know, disabled. It was just tough.
Others barricaded themselves in offices and prayed. Lopez was killed in the shootout. Hillary Lane, CBS News.
Up next, the world's most famous mouse turns 90.
M-I-C-K-E-Y-M-O-U-S-E.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
CBS News Radio presents the Intelligence Matters Podcast, taking you inside the biggest stories in national security.
How concerned are you?
I'm concerned that the Russians never left.
Each week, former acting director of the CIA, Michael Morell, interviews top leaders from the U.S. intelligence community.
James Clapper, Senator Mark Warner of Virginia, Mike Hayden.
And lucky for you, you won't need a security clearance to listen. The Intelligence Matters Podcast. Subscribe now on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Stitcher. From the Capital One Bank Studios in Washington, this is the CBS News Weekend Roundup. Here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
Ahead of the holiday season, the U.S. Public Interest Research Group released its 33rd annual Toy Safety Report. Consumer Campaign Director Mike Litt talks about the dangers and the toys they found.
Over the last 30 years, our report has led to at least 150 recalls and other actions to get dangerous toys off store shelves. Sadly, our researchers once again found potentially unsafe toys this year on store shelves.
The groups raised concerns about toys that may be toxic and pose choking hazards. It was a big week for Mickey Mouse in the spotlight as he celebrated a landmark birthday. Here's correspondent Steve Futterman in Los Angeles.
He is the most famous mouse in the world, and this past week he celebrated his 90th birthday.
Who's the leader of the clock that's made for you and me?
It was on November 18, 1928, that the first cartoon featuring Mickey Mouse debuted, Steamboat Willie. In that historic debut, we don't hear what became Mickey's familiar high-pitched voice. That would come later.
That's all for today.
Pluto, Gary Apgar is author of Mickey Mouse, Emblem of the American Spirit.
He's, I think, the most iconic figure in our culture, in history, period. And I think he's the most universal, appealing to young and old. And again, to me, he is truly an emblem of America and the American spirit. He's cheerful, energetic, and all that. And, there's a childlike quality to him that is innocent, too. And so he's a symbol of America at its best.
Mickey Mouse became the central figure in Walt Disney's entertainment empire. There would eventually be other characters, Pluto, Goofy, Donald Duck, but Mickey was the first and the most important. Walt Disney once described how he came up with the Mickey character. It was on a train from New York to Los Angeles. Disney had just lost the rights to his most popular character at the time, Oswald the Rabbit. He needed to come up with a replacement.
Mrs. Disney and I were coming back from New York on the train, and I had to have something. I said, by the time I get to Hollywood, I must have something to, I can't tell him I've lost Oswald. So I had this mouse in the back of my head.
Today, Mickey Mouse is known by hundreds of millions, perhaps billions of people. The smiling face, the red shorts, the yellow shoes. But Gary Apgar says the early Mickey Mouse did not always have a pristine image.
Because he became so popular with children. Walt even complained about this in 1933, 34, 35, when Mickey was like 5 years old or less. He said it got to a point where they couldn't have him do anything that was out of the ordinary. He had to be, you know, almost a goody two-shoes. But originally, in the second Mickey Mouse cartoon, Gallopin' Gaucho, he's smoking cigarettes, blowing smoke rings, drinking beer, dancing a mean tango with Minnie Mouse. But that had to go.
How important was Mickey Mouse to Walt Disney's success? Disney once described it this way. It was, he said, all started by a mouse. Steve Futterman, CBS News, Los Angeles.
Some companies are trying to get people to think twice about what they wear and use in their homes amid concerns about worldwide waste and its impact on the earth.
We keep everything, and now we're making like amazing pieces of art out of scraps.
At a tiny factory in Irvington, New York,
they're deconstructed.
Eileen Fisher's small but mighty team of socially conscious employees are trying to make a dent in fashion's carbon footprint.
We get between 4,000 and 6,000 pieces a week.
4,000 and 6,000 pieces a week.
The Renew program buys back worn Eileen Fisher pieces and sorts them to determine if they can be resold, resewn.
This was a hole.
Yeah.
They made it part of the design.
Or remade.
This is made from about 20 old sweaters.
We see it as an important long-term investment for us. It's a bit hard to rationalize that cost. We do it because we think it's the right thing to do. And because we believe there's going to be no business done on a dead planet, so we better do the best we can.
Fashion accounts for nearly 10% of greenhouse gas emissions, and 85% of unwanted clothing ends up in landfills like this one, piling up to more than 12 million tons annually.
When you think about the magnitude, does it ever seem overwhelming for
yes.
you?
Yes. Oh, it's daunting. It's, some days I try not to get depressed. Some days I say, oh, my God, it feels like we're moving deck chairs on the Titanic. It's like, oh, how many more years do we have, 12, before catastrophe strikes us? We're only a drop in the bucket, and we're trying to role model for other companies.
Other companies have tapped into the sustainable market, too, like Patagonia, whose Worn Wear program encourages customers to patch up old clothing rather than buy new. Even IKEA is testing a program to buy back their old furniture. And H&M offers a recycling program where customers get 15% off when they bring in used items. But sustainability expert Maxine Bidot says coupons just encourage more consumption, and only about 1 out of every 1,000 pieces sold is ever recycled.
The last figures that have come in are showing that there are 150 billion new pieces of clothing that are made every single year. If you look even at the global population, that's a disposable wardrobe for every man, woman, and child on the planet every single year. I tend to favor natural material over synthetics. You can see things are pulling.
She says consumers need to be more conscious shoppers.
You don't have to be wealthy to make these sustainable choices.
Exactly. You can learn a lot from the clothes just from looking at the tag and looking at the inside of the garment. And I think that's the takeaway. It's not about, you know, getting a PhD in sustainability. It's about finding the clothes that we really love and only using our hard-earned money to purchase things that we're really going to want to wear in the future.
Eileen Fisher's Renew program has sold nearly $3 million of garments that would otherwise have ended up in landfills. And finding ways to reuse versus throwing away unwanted clothing can actually save taxpayer dollars. In New York City alone, it cost $85 million each year to collect and dispose of textiles. Elaine Quijano, CBS News, New York.
Coming up on the Weekend Roundup, the popularity of one Christmas collectible.
They have a separate Christmas tree just for their White House Christmas ornaments.
Follow us on Twitter. We've got headlines at CBS News Radio. And I'm tweeting at Steve_Dorsey on the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
They're unwelcome callers, and now the FCC wants companies to do more to fight back.
This is Susan with Credit Card Relief.
You qualify for a 75% savings.
Experts say by early next year, nearly 50% of all cell phone calls will be scam robocalls.
I knew the phone number, I could see that it was scam, and I could send it away.
At T-Mobile, Vice President Grant Castle showed us his company's latest tool, an app called Name ID that allows users to block specific types of calls, everything from nuisance calls.
And I have a business model that literally put $500,000 in my pocket.
To political calls, even prison calls.
So with this new app, customers have better control over what they would like to see and what they don't want to see.
But the FCC is also pushing companies to meet new standards known by the acronym Shake and Stir. It's a complicated process, but the result is a sort of digital fingerprint to show that the people making and receiving the calls are real, not a scammer trying to spoof or imitate a phone number.
Every time we make an improvement, the scammers make a change. And so it's an arms race to see, you know, who can trick who.
You will be taken under custody by the local cops.
You just don't get the calls anymore. And that's
Aaron Foss founded Nomo Robo. It's a robocall blocking app for phones. He says those new Shake and Stir standards are good up to a point.
What it doesn't do is it doesn't say if that call is legal. It doesn't say anything about the content. It just says that that number is allowed to be called. So we're absolutely not going to solve the whole robocall problem.
If companies don't move to address robocalls quickly enough, they may face more pressure from lawmakers from both parties, some of whom filed legislation to try to combat robocalls with a $10,000 fine per illegal call. Anna Werner, CBS News, New York.
One of the stars of a hit Netflix show, heading to the UN.
14-year-old British actress Millie Bobby Brown has become the youngest ever goodwill ambassador for the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF. The star of the hit drama series Stranger Things says she plans to address bullying and poverty. Brown was also the youngest person to make Time magazine's list of the world's 100 most influential figures. The UN says her appointment marks World Children's Day. Pam Coulter, CBS News.
Something to put on your gift list.
A year after winning a Grammy for Best Traditional Blues Album, Blue and Lonesome, the Rolling Stones are bringing their impressive catalog to the U.S. Their No Filter tour begins in Florida next April and ends in Chicago in June. Lead singer Mick Jagger says it's a thrill to play stadiums in the States because the energy is always amazing. The Stones have only played in Europe for the past 2 years. Allison Keys, CBS News.
It's an annual tradition for folks across the country collecting the White House Christmas ornament. Each unique, each telling the story of a part of the White House or a past president. The group behind it, the White House Historical Association. Its president, Stuart McLaurin, joins us on the line. Stuart, tell us about the history of the ornament.
Well, thank you, Steve. I'm happy to tell you about this wonderful project of the White House Historical Association that we've undertaken since 1981. And each year we feature a different president or presidency on this official White House Christmas ornament. And it's a history teaching tool in and of itself. Yes, it decorates a Christmas tree, but people collect these and they have now starting into the next generation. And each one tells wonderful historical facts. And we highlight a couple of key stories during the presidency that we're featuring on the ornament. It's always fun to create and it's very popular to collect.
What is this year's ornament featuring?
Well, it's Harry Truman and the 33rd president of the United States. And here's years in the White House, which were quite transformative. You know the story that the White House had fallen to a great state of disrepair. The Trumans moved out for 4 years and moved across the street to the Blair House, and the White House was completely gutted and rebuilt from the entire interior, the entire infrastructure, and then built back out in the same, basically the same configuration that it was. And he added the controversial but famous Truman balcony on the south portico that's featured on this ornament. Also, the redesign of the presidential seal is featured, which was confirmed by President Truman, started under Roosevelt, but then confirmed under Truman. And then the third historical element that we feature on this year's ornament is the Blue Room, as depicted during the Truman administration after the White House was rebuilt. So those are the three key features, but also included is a little history booklet that unpacks more stories about those Truman years. And I have to say, I'm very grateful to my predecessors who started this tradition back in 1981. During the Reagan administration, it was decided that a different president would be featured each year sequentially. So we don't have to decide who we're going to feature in any given year. That's decided for us.
Now, why was that Truman balcony, his namesake architectural addition to the White House, so controversial?
Well, the south portico, the rounded part of the White House exterior, was added after it was rebuilt from the British fire. Remember, the British burned it right in 1814. It took 3 years to rebuild. Several years later, the south portico really became into fruition as an architectural element of the White House. But the president and his family really didn't have a place like most American families have, a porch, or a deck, a patio, a terrace. And so they wanted a place where they could go outside off the residential level on the second floor and enjoy time as a family to have a meal or read the paper or quiet conversation. And that's what the famous Truman balcony provides. It was controversial because it broke up the pure flow of the columns on the south portico from the ground all the way to the top. But now we look at it and see it, and it's a very natural part of that facade to us today.
How popular are these ornaments that have now spent nearly, 40 years?
Yeah, very popular. They are collected by those who use them for themselves and those who give them as gifts. Each year we have people that come in and buy the entire collection going back to 1981. We continue to make them each year, and it's important to mention that these are American-made by a veteran-owned small business in Rhode Island. Every component of them is made here in the United States. And so they're American-made. They tell the stories of the American president and the People's House. The White House belongs to the people of our country. And we're happy to teach and tell the stories of the White House and its history through these wonderful Christmas ornaments. So we sell many, many of these ornaments every year, and some people start collecting them. People give them as creative gifts. We'll have people come in and buy them the year ornament for someone whose birthday was that year, or a bridesmaid will come in and buy this year's ornament for all of her bridesmaids. So there are all kinds of creative ways of using them and giving them. We have had many stories, and people send us pictures where they've now collected so many that they have a separate Christmas tree just for their White House Christmas ornaments.
A tradition that continues. White House Historical Association President Stuart McLaurin on the weekend roundup. Happy Thanksgiving and Merry Christmas, Stuart.
Thanks, Steve. Same to you.
Coming up, the tragic whereabouts of the late radio DJ Casey Kasem.
He lies in an unmarked grave in Oslo, Norway.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup.
The CBS News Weekend Roundup after this short break.
This is The Takeout with Major Garrett.
Every week, an extended conversation at a restaurant in our nation's capital with newsmakers like Democratic Senator Mark Warner.
What we want to try to do is give the American people the truth.
Trump cabinet member Linda McMahon.
First time that I met Donald Trump was at a Rolling Stones concert.
Neil deGrasse Tyson. He has keys to the universe.
Actually, it's a key fob.
Right. You have a fob to the universe. Politics, policy, and a side of pop culture. The Takeout with me, Major Garrett.
On the CBS News Weekend Roundup, here's correspondent Steve Dorsey.
We've all got something to be thankful for this holiday season, sometimes whether we realize it or not. And one program in Central Florida is teaching students the value of second chances. CBS News correspondent Peter King reports on the Second Harvest program, where Thanksgiving meals are used as lessons for a future in food.
The meal includes turkey, stuffing, much more.
Mashed potatoes, gravy from scratch.
They're not for the homeless, but they're being prepared by people bouncing back from hardships like homelessness. Chef Jill Holland is the taskmaster and teacher at Second Harvest Catering for Good.
Our program mimics probably the first semester and a half of a culinary training program at a college.
All in 16 weeks.
In 16 weeks, yep.
A meal for eight costs $135.
All of our proceeds go back into the culinary training program.
It's a classroom, all right, but in a real-world environment.
The catering is a business. We have to have it out at a certain time. We have to have that certain level of perfection.
Holland says the program has graduated some 250 people in the past 5 years.
We have students, graduates who are working at the Disney hotels, at the Disney parks, at Universal, at the Lowe's hotels, Marriott's.
And when Holland talks about people restarting their lives, she thinks of several students in particular. One woman named Shaniqua.
She and her children were living in their car, and then one day her car caught on fire. And there went everything that she owned.
Holland says Shaniqua now works here, helping other people who were once in difficult circumstances like she was. Maria is one of those students and says this program has changed her life.
Very, very happy. I'm always happy when I get up in the morning to go to school. You learn everything, and it's a good environment.
And then there's Walter Young. He's not a student here, but he worked in the hospitality industry for 6 years and says working here is much better.
I'm given a chance to give back, which I love to do.
Walter right now is making our cranberry chutney. Apparently he's taking my count very literal on those cloves. You can ask any of my people. I'm a demanding chef.
But Jill Holland is clearly one who absolutely loves what she's doing here.
I figured out what I wanted to do when I grew up. You know? Now I just have to grow up.
I'm Peter King, CBS News, at the Second Harvest Food Bank in Orlando.
Hello again, and welcome to American Top 40. I'm Casey Kasem, and this is our countdown.
You'll probably remember that voice of radio DJ Casey Kasem, who counted down the country's top songs for decades. Now 48 Hours is examining his death and the bizarre family dispute after. 48 Hours correspondent Peter Van Sant is in New York. Peter, remind us how Casey Kasem died and then the fallout from his death.
Well, it really goes back in terms of the nation's memory to May 2014. Suddenly, Casey Kasem, this radio icon, disappears. His children from his first marriage go on cable television, on radio. Where is our father? They file a missing persons report because he was suffering from a Parkinson's-like disorder, and he had disappeared with his wife, Jeannie Kasem. And that's when everything hit the front pages. It turned out he had been taken from a rehab facility in Santa Barbara, California, and placed in an SUV, his various tubes disconnected. He eventually was driven to Las Vegas, where he was then flown by Learjet to Seattle, where he was then taken by a vehicle to Silverdale, Washington, which is on the Kitsap Peninsula, to the mother's house of a childhood friend of Jeannie Kasem, Casey Kasem's second wife. And it was there that the big confrontation occurred, where Carrie Kasem, one of the children from the first marriage, learned where he was, got a court order to be able to take her father to a hospital for an examination. That's where, in front of cameras, there is a confrontation between Jeannie and Carrie. Jeannie throws raw meat at her, and off he goes to a hospital. And about 2 weeks later, on June 15th, 2014, he dies. And there are two wrongful death lawsuits that have been filed. Carrie Kasem and her sister and brother have accused Jeannie, the widow, of elder abuse and creating circumstances that led to a premature death. So they have sued her for wrongful death, and she has sued back, claiming that there was a murder conspiracy by the biological children to gain control of Casey Kasem and direct physicians to disconnect his feeding tube, his hydration, and his medicine. And as they said, they left him alone on a desert island to die.
I imagine this dispute, as so many family disputes after the death of a loved one are, is about money. How much could they be arguing over, if at all?
Now, when you, I've interviewed Carrie Kasem, the daughter, Jeannie Kasem, the widow. Both say this is not about the money. This is about the love they had for this man. But Casey Kasem leaves behind an estate worth between $80 and $100 million. He has a $42 million mansion in Bel Air, California, in Los Angeles, that sits empty today. And in the children's lawsuit, they are seeking unspecified damages. So clearly money is a part of this. And Jeannie Kasem believes that those children don't deserve anything more than the life insurance policy which was distributed between the three of them after their father's death.
He was, of course, by most measures, a pop culture icon in his own right. But his remains, Peter, from what I can tell, are far from public, right?
Yeah, this is a part of this strange, strange story continued after death. And he continued to travel after death. His body was taken from Silverdale, Washington, this little town on the Kitsap Peninsula, to Seattle, flown to Montreal, Canada, where he was kept on ice for some weeks. He then went from there to Oslo, Norway, where today Casey Kasem, this American icon, an all-American man who lived in Los Angeles for more than 50 years, he lies in an unmarked grave in Oslo, Norway, a grave that his biological children have not seen, a grave that a Swedish fan of Casey Kasem's found, and she shoots video on her iPhone. Her name is Unki, and she speaks English on this and says, "Oh, Casey, I've put fall colors on your grave," and it is a bizarre resting place in a bizarre story.
The bizarre story of the American voice of Top 40 in radio. You can catch Peter's story on 48 Hours this weekend on CBS TV or stream it anytime on CBS All Access. That does it for this Thanksgiving edition of the Weekend Roundup. Thanks for listening. The show's always online on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Stitcher, and Spotify. We want to get your feedback. Drop us a line at weekendroundup@cbsnews.com and let us know where and how you're listening this holiday. The Weekend Roundup is produced at the CBS News Washington Bureau. Have a great long Thanksgiving weekend. I'm Steve Dorsey, CBS News.